Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Economic policy is, in many cases, much more violent than individuals who are suffering from that economic policy. At least it's more responsible for that.
That's the voice of Dr. Adrian Pine. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Pine about the ongoing institutionalized violence in Honduras and how that violence disproportionately affects women and other marginalized groups, how the women of Honduras are courageously fighting back and organizing, and what feminists can learn in North America about their struggle. So stay tuned.
Someone who has done a beautiful job not only connecting us across borders, my next guest, Dr. Adrian Pine, has spent a lot of time researching and working in Central America, and I'm very privileged to have her on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Now, when I look at the world today, I think of the Tropic of Chaos, as Dr. Christian Parenti calls it, you know, this convergence of neoliberalism, globalization, and this uberism of power, you know, enacted by military force. And so we're caught in this tsunami of a storm that at times it feels, well, what do we do? And it seems to me that in North America, at least, there's a sense that resignation, you know, we can't change it. But in Latin America, in other parts of the world, people see this as a challenge that we have to face on, that, you know, that takes courage. And it doesn't mean we're not scared, but it means we have to act. I wonder if you could talk about your experience, you know, working in Honduras, you know, after a military coup, in the wake of rampant violence in this country.
Certainly. One of the things that was most impressive following the military coup was how strongly and how widespread the resistance movement came together to oppose the kind of violence that we were seeing, that not only usurped democracy, that the electoral democracy that Hondurans had believed they had, but violently repressed people who stood up against that usurpation on a day-to-day basis. And one of the forms of violence that was most pronounced was violence against women as a specific political tool that the military and police in particular were using. So in marches, whereas they might just beat or shoot tear gas at men, at women or at other feminized people, including gay men or trans people, police were using actual sexual attacks, were raping victims with batons or raping them themselves, were hitting them particularly on their breasts, on their behinds and on their vaginas and regions, whether or not they, you know, were derobing them beforehand. And that was part of an overall politics that we saw in the coup that was very anti-women. And people recognized this specifically and specifically fought against it. So you had feminists coming together, and women who were very new to feminism, who really came to feminism through the process of the coup and through recognizing how violent it was specifically to women, who came out with this new slogan that became very popular, which is "Ni golpes al Estado, ni golpes a la mujer." Which in Spanish means no coups d'etat and no beating women. And of course, in Spanish, golpe, the word for coup, means to beat, and so it's the same word. So women were consciously linking together everyday violence against women against this much larger instance of violence against both the state and against women collectively in a call to organize for justice, for women's rights, and for everyone's rights. There was widespread mobilization in response to this, to these specific kinds of violence.
You know, when we think about violence, we know that more men died in terms, you know, in military conflicts, and but I wonder about the kind of targeted violence, as you point out, and the relationship to a world that Silvia Federici makes the point that the women have become the commons now. You know, when everything has been privatized and plundered, what's left, right? What's left is the bodies, and we were also, you know, it seems to me, the foundational pillars under which capitalism was planted and enacted itself, right? The expropriation of our labor. I wonder if we could talk about the impact that this neoliberalism and globalization of capital has.
Somehow it's been more difficult for us in the United States to see those linkages. And I, you know, I don't have a theory other than the overwhelming hegemony that the media has in the United States, although I do think that it goes beyond that. In Latin America, people are quick to make the connections with the violence of neoliberalism and the violence of their everyday lives. And I think that's an advantage that I've seen, and in particular in the case of Honduras. And perhaps because it is felt as more immediate. While people are now losing their homes in the United States, for example, as a result of violent neoliberal policies, this is something that Hondurans on a broader scale have been dealing with for much longer. And so when we see that people lose their homes, women in particular are often more immediately impacted, particularly when women are the primary caregivers for children and are not only, it's not only them being kicked out, but them being kicked out along with the people that they have to take care of. And since there are so many women-headed homes in Honduras, that becomes a particularly, in those cases, feminized form of violence that is accompanied by violent neoliberal policies. Just to look at the case of the Bajo Aguan, for example, where large landholders who are benefiting from economic neoliberal policies that have deregulated and that have weakened the laws of the agrarian reform or otherwise allowed large landholders to take land that does not pertain to them, and that results in people being often forcibly and violently kicked out of their homes, that the burden of that violence in particular falls on women, who are the ones who are, as you say, the foundational pillars of the community. They're the ones who are, you know, most responsible, in a sense, for reproducing culture, not just reproducing biologically, but as the primary caregivers of children. They're the ones that experience most immediately that violence. But what is, I think, hopeful in this horrible situation is that many of the women who I've spoken with, including on a recent trip to the Bajo Aguan, directly make these links themselves. They see this violence as part of the violence of neoliberalism, and as such conceive of their fight as a fight against neoliberalism and all that it entails, in this case the military coup that strengthened neoliberal policies in the region, the landowners that are hiring the police and military and paramilitary security guards to carry out violence against them. They see the fight as being beyond the immediate circumstances, the immediate people evicting them, and pertaining to international economic policy. And I think that having that analysis is really the only way that it's possible to begin to fight the real causes of this violence against women and violence against society.
I want to talk a little bit about North America, because while we look at the South and we say, well, of course the women there are repressed, the men there are machistas, and there is a history of sexism, we overlook the fact that violence happens to women in North America as well. And I think increasingly now that, you know, with an economic downturn where scarcity seems to be rampant everywhere, as that competition increases, as that friction, you know, among people increases, I see that violence not only exacerbating but becoming very targeted locally as well. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, in particularly, the barriers that we face, because I think that the simplistic explanations that we have for Latin America are somewhat based on racial bias that we have about the South.
Yeah, that's very much true, and that's true not just for U.S. feminism's relationship vis-a-vis Latin America, but in particular our relationship vis-a-vis the Middle East and countries that are identified as Muslim, for example. This, you know, the rhetoric leading up to the war in Afghanistan was about how violent the Taliban was towards women. And of course the assumption there is always that in the United States we're so much better. Well, we're not doing that well in terms of women's rights and the way that women's bodies are treated in the United States in particular, as we've seen in the kind of debates that have been going on, going backwards in terms of women's rights in the Republican debates, but you know, the Democrats are not that much better. So, you know, there's this sense that we are better, that the feminist movement succeeded, that we've come so far. We never even got the Equal Rights Amendment in the United States never even passed, and the wage differential is horrible, and et cetera, et cetera. And in Honduras, you know, we tend to talk about Honduras, and as you mentioned, other Latin American countries, as, you know, as suffering because of machismo, as suffering because of this culture of violence against women. But if you look at the situation historically and structurally, that is not a viable explanation. Again, to take the example of the coup, following the coup, which was supported by the United States, we saw femicides shoot up, that is, the specific violent killing of women in sexualized ways. We saw the killings of in particular trans women and gay men, also feminized bodies, shoot up after the coup, talking about by five times. And other specific acts that we saw happen following the coup, that again was supported by the United States, was the introduction of a law banning emergency contraception, in other words, making it a crime for women, even women who had been raped, or minors, taking emergency contraception, which is contraception, the morning after pill, which delays conception just like regular contraception does, and banning it, making it a crime for women to use that pill, so making them criminals, jail time for birth control. This is the most extreme anti-birth control measure anywhere in the world. And it was a law that had been passed prior to the coup, but President Zelaya vetoed it. One of the reasons the coup was carried out was there was such a strong anti-women bias among the people who wanted to carry out the coup. That was one of the things that was used as legitimation and gave power to the Opus Dei, which was one of the big backers of the coup, a very anti-women, anti-gay movement within the Catholic Church that the highest ranking figure in Honduras in the Catholic Church, Cardinal Rodriguez, pertains to. And also the coup was backed by a very right-wing anti-women evangelical groups. And so the allowing this coup to stand, in doing that and in supporting it, the United States, not Honduran machista culture, but the United States is responsible for these moves backward for women and the huge amount of violence against women and other feminized bodies.
I think that's a very important point to make because, well, we look always for the simplistic explanation, you know, that's why. We often neglect to see the many points that, you know, that interconnect to make that violence be endemic and persistent and continuous as it has been. What lessons can we learn in North America from the examples of resistance that you've witnessed in Honduras, particularly of the women and their social movements?
You know, I think one thing that that women in Honduras and throughout Latin America have used to great effect is the social position that gives them power as women. And, you know, of course, to some degree, unfortunately, that it's their position, their role as mothers, that really has a lot of social capital in Honduras. But they've used that in a way that has been really powerful. So the mothers in the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina marched silently for many years, and, you know, that's, of course, one of the things that eventually toppled the dictatorship, marched for their children and their grandchildren. In Honduras, we've seen the mothers who have had their children killed in the land rights struggle in the Aguan come together in solidarity with the mothers in Comayagua who where just on Valentine's Day of this year, there were over 360 prisoners who were killed in what was basically a massacre in a prison fire where the police who were working as prison guards refused to open the cell blocks where the prisoners were being held and allowed them to burn to death in that fire. And some of the most powerful voices of protest against this kind of violence have really been women in their roles as mothers, have come out and said, you know, we are, as you said, the foundational pillars of society. You know, we are mothers just like your mothers, and we are suffering not just because we lost our children, but because the state is helping to kill our children. And that's a very powerful statement that has been used by mothers organizing throughout Latin America. And, you know, and I think what I'm getting at is that, you know, we can recognize that the kinds of things that we suffer as women in the United States, in the rest of North America, those aren't personal forms of suffering only. They're political forms of suffering that we can organize around. So, you know, we've seen people who are in professions that are, you know, largely dominated by women can really use that that as a means for organizing. Nurses in the United States have really used the fact that nursing is an institution that centers around the concept of care, which historically has been a very feminized concept, but actually they've used to great effect to say that care is actually something political. If we don't have the proper resources to care for our patients, we can't care for them. If money is the most important end in a hospital care, then that actually goes against providing real care for our patients, because profit will be more important than healing patients. And so using these concepts that have been traditionally feminized and devalued, like motherhood, like care, and turning that around and saying, no, if we want to really value these concepts, what we need to be doing is fighting against the violent form of neoliberal capitalism. And that's the only way that these concepts will be able to, you know, that we'll be able to use them in a positive and healing manner.
Thank you so much for being with us. You have a book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras. Tell us about it.
Sure. My book came out a year before the coup, so I'm actually really, really glad to have that background and to have thought about a lot of these issues about state violence prior to the military coup, because one of my biggest questions while I was writing it is, you know, why don't people resist more in Honduras? There's so much violence. There was so much violence already that was carried out before the coup. And I had this question. And so it was so exciting to see the contrast of the kind of violence that neoliberalism carries out against men and women's bodies in Honduras being responded to in a very different way before and after the coup. So although there was targeted violence, in particular against young men that I talk about in the book, before the coup, it only became recognized as a politics of the state and a politics of the of neoliberalism on a broad scale following the coup. And it was with that recognition that we were able to see people rising up and, you know, and really starting to question the violence that they experienced on a day-to-day basis. One of the more popular sayings was, well, the coup took off our blindfolds, or the coup took off everyone's masks. And what that meant was the politicians who people had previously believed were working in their interest, suddenly their masks came off, and people understood that they were working in the interests of capital, of the 10 most powerful families who are considered to be the oligarchy in Honduras, and in particular for women, that they were working specifically against women's rights to their own bodies and to economic justice. And so, you know, in the book, I kind of lay out the history of political violence and how it's understood as personal violence, or it's understood as cultural violence, when, from my perspective, it had a lot more to do with violent institutions and, in particular, neoliberal economic policies than with the sort of cultural explanations that were being given, similar to the same cultural explanations that we in the United States or in Canada, people will give to Latin American violence, that somehow it's just natural, or that it has to do with machismo. You know, people in Honduras would give the same explanations, but my analysis of the situation was that actually economic policy is, in many cases, much more violent than individuals who are suffering from that economic policy. At least it's more responsible for that. So I looked in particular at the maquiladora industry, which is the textile factory industry, which has industrialized much of Honduras, but to the great detriment of the environment, to labor rights, and to women specifically, who make up the bulk of the labor force for these factories, and how ironically, maquiladora factories were seen as a force for progress, whereas the violence that was seen as springing up all around them was interpreted as a problem that was endemic to Honduran culture, even though in many cases it was new. It came up around the factories, like we see violence around factories in Ciudad Juarez, for example. So I was trying to parse that out and provide a broader structural and political analysis that that now, following the coup, I'm glad that I had the chance to do beforehand, so I can compare and contrast.
When I hear you say that, I think about the way we ignore sometimes the signs that are all around us, you know, and that at times I think that seems naive. Perhaps we just don't see it. At times I think it is complicit. And I'm very happy that, you know, your book does a really good job not only describing those institutions of violence, as you call them, but also signaling that if these institutions are put on by men, we can also take them down, right, and put something else in place.
Well, that's been one of the central pushes of the resistance movement, which has gone through a number of phases in Honduras since the coup, which really gave birth to it. But you know, one of the central tenets, we could say, of the people who are in the resistance movement is that the country really needs to be refounded, that there needs to be a constituent assembly to rewrite the constitution, which of course was the reason, the straw that broke the camel's back in the coup itself being carried out. The coup was carried out on the day that President Zelaya had planned to carry out a non-binding poll to ask citizens whether or not they would like to have this constituent assembly to rewrite the Honduran constitution, precisely because it was so anti-democratic and it so favored the power, the concentration of power into just a few hands. And people were very excited about being able to not just express their democratic desires through voting once every 4 years, as they do in Honduras, but actually become more involved in a democracy that's more real, a participatory democracy. And the idea that that Zelaya was promoting, which was an idea that came from the ground up, was that groups, the people who would rewrite the constitution would come from popular movements all over the country, and therefore the constitution would be much more representative and would help to create a process by which all sorts of people who have been traditionally oppressed by the concentration of wealth in Honduras, in particular indigenous people, women, LGBT people, Afro-Caribbean people, would have much more of a say in their so-called democracy. And so that's still one of the primary goals that the resistance movement holds on to, and I think that sees as being really the foundation for being able to finally overturn the coup, which has become institutionalized in Honduras.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Adrienne Pine, and her book is Amazing Working Hard, Drinking Hard, Adrienne Pine. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Cambia lo superficial.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.